This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Between Europe's problems and the market crash, it's been a while since we've talked real estate. Today on the broadcast, the falling foreclosure rate and what that really means. Shoppers getting fewer choices and being happier because of it. And the business end of a British garden. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Constant Contact, working to help small businesses understand what social media can do for them. Learn more at constantcontact.com/social media.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 13th of May, and it is great to have you with us. You know, one of the downsides of being on later in the daily business news cycle is that a lot of the key economic numbers come out pretty early in the morning. So you've probably already heard the foreclosure figure by now, a report that says they're down both month to month and on an annual basis as well. And that, on the face of it, is good. Until you read a little bit deeper and you discover that the number of houses being repossessed is up 45%. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to break down those numbers and what they might mean for the housing market.
Foreclosure is a legal process. It can take anywhere from a couple of months to more than a year. The repossession happens at the end. It's when the bank actually takes the keys. Today's report comes from a website called RealtyTrack, and it says banks have been initiating fewer foreclosures, but finishing more of them.
They're focusing less on moving people into foreclosure and more on processing the loans that are already in foreclosure.
Rick Sharga works at RealtyTrack, and he says this is a change in the way banks are dealing with foreclosures.
The banks are trying to clear those out before they initiate new ones.
Some people who watch the housing market say the way RealtyTrack counts is misleading, and they point out that monthly numbers almost always jump around. But they do agree a lot of people are still losing their homes. Alan White's a professor at the Valparaiso University Law School. He says there's a huge inventory of foreclosed properties on the market.
That inventory obviously puts downward pressure on home prices. So until we can stop increasing the number of foreclosed homes and homeowners facing foreclosure, we're going to continue to see a decline in home values.
White says housing prices won't really recover until people start getting jobs again, and homeowners whose properties are worth less than their mortgages stop walking away. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Washington is still digesting the Senate Energy and Climate Bill that was released yesterday. What it's going to mean for manufacturers and power companies, nuclear plants and offshore drilling, there is a little something in there for everybody. The ultimate goal, of course, is to cut back on greenhouse gas emissions. Trick is, it's kind of hard to do that if we keep on using fossil fuels the way we are. So does this legislation help get the United States off coal and oil and natural gas? Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk.
Tyson Slocum is director of Public Citizens Energy Program. He says if you think this legislation will transform our energy economy, don't hold your breath.
This is a bill that reflects a mantra of don't rock the boat, don't upset large utilities or the coal industry, and if you need to accommodate those interests, you're not going to get an effective climate bill.
Slocum says Senate Democrats have made so many concessions to the fossil fuel industry in order to garner support, they've essentially maintained the status quo. He says the bill expands offshore oil drilling, shells out $2 billion a year to big coal for so-called clean coal technology, and contains no federal mandate for a renewable electricity standard. That's where the government makes utilities get a certain percentage of their power from sources like wind and solar. David Doniger at the Natural Resources Defense Council says, yes, compromises have been made, but the bill does place a federal cap on carbon pollution for the first time ever.
That alone tilts investment very sharply in favor of cleaner fuels. It doesn't make sense to invest in old coal plant technology when you have to carry the costs of controlling the carbon pollution.
The bill also provides $54 billion in loan guarantees for new nuclear reactors. Nuclear is a controversial power source, but one that supporters say still does help to shift the U.S. away from fossil fuels. Harvard's Robert Stavins.
If one is trying to address global climate change, then surely part of the portfolio of action going forward is going to be nuclear power.
And Stavins says natural gas will be part of that transition because it's cleaner than oil or coal. But whether this bill lets carbon prices go high enough to make fossil fuels a turnoff is another question. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Even though the recession is waning, states are still trying to come to grips with enormous budget deficits. They've cut hundreds of programs to fill their budget gaps. Some of the biggest cuts have been aimed at health care. Lawsuits have forced states to keep most of that money in place, but California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has just about had it. So tomorrow he's going to try something new, get rid of those health care programs entirely. Jeff Horowitz reports.
Home health care for the elderly, insurance subsidies for poor pregnant women. Even states in serious budget trouble don't usually consider killing benefits like these, especially when they come with big federal money attached. Much better to trim a little all around, spread the pain. Schwarzenegger spokesman Aaron McClear says California tried that.
Federal judges have kind of tied our hands and our ability to have flexibility to make some cuts. They've basically said that we can't cut back on certain programs, but we can eliminate them.
So tomorrow, the governor will announce which health care programs are simply going to disappear.
Without raising taxes, you have to cut programs, and it's simple math.
Actually, a little simple math might get California and other states out of this particular mess. Edwin Park is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He says courts have mostly rejected the cuts on technicalities.
The courts have found that the state, in a number of these rate reductions, failed to do the necessary analysis, and those kind of studies weren't done.
Even if California lawmakers go along, Park can't believe Schwarzenegger will forfeit the huge streams of Medicaid dollars or jeopardize the benefits of federal health care reform, not to mention
so many millions of families, seniors, and people with disabilities rely on the program in some form or another.
Today, Schwarzenegger also announced his Plan B, an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, joined by 22 other states, to restore the original, more gentle cuts. I'm Jeff Horowitz for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street were chugging right along today, not up, not really down, until just before the bell when the bottom fell out. Not in a last Thursday kind of bottom falling out way, but in a down a percent or a little bit more kind of way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Remember when everybody was sharing music online and not paying for it, and how the music industry started suing to get people to stop doing that? Independent filmmakers remember, too. The producers of the Oscar-winning movie The Hurt Locker and their lawyers say they have identified thousands of people who've grabbed the film illegally from peer-to-peer sites online. They're not suing right off the bat, though. They're giving people a chance to come clean at a price. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
The Oscar effect on the Hurt Locker sales was explosive.
Go! Everybody get back! Go, go, go!
The day after the awards, it was the most bought movie on iTunes. It topped Amazon's on-demand service, and DVD sales spiked. By the way, I borrowed that clip from the Hurt Locker trailer. It's on YouTube. Dozens of comments posted below the video direct you to sites where you can download the movie for free. Thomas Dunlap is a lawyer with the U.S. Copyright Group. He's representing the film's producers. He says more people bought the Hurt Locker after the Oscars, but more people stole it, too.
Assume just for argument's sake, you could add 500,000 sales because of an Oscar. If that's how many torrent downloads there are of a given film, that's how many sales were actually lost.
Dunlap's firm has subpoenaed internet service providers. It wants information on tens of thousands of people who may have downloaded the Hurt Locker illegally. It plans to send letters that say the firm will sue if the downloaders don't settle out of court. Robert Thompson teaches film at Syracuse University. He says no big movie companies have filed a suit like this, but he says he's not surprised indie filmmakers are first.
An independent filmmaker might have a lot more at stake than, you know, a studio that's releasing, you know, an enormous summer blockbuster.
The Hurt Locker is the most high-profile client for the U.S. copyright group. The firm has already filed suit on behalf of a handful of other titles and convinced several people to pay. Lawyer Thomas Dunlap wouldn't say how much money Hurt Locker producers want from each downloader, but he said it's less than $15,000. I'm Eve Troe from Marketplace.
The CEO of Deutsche Bank said today he is not at all sure that Greece is going to be able to pay back what it owes. He does have logic on his side. Despite deep spending cuts, Greece still does have a long way to go to make its investors whole. A third of all the jobs in that country are in the public sector. There's widespread tax evasion and rioting in the streets. It is, by any measure, a difficult situation to be in, not least for young Greeks. The unemployment rate for them, for people between 18 and 30, is more than 25%. From Athens, Joanna Kakissis reports.
On a Sunday night in central Athens, Alex Yokaris stands in a small crowd of mourners outside the charred remains of the Marfin Egnatia Bank. Three bank employees died recently when a fringe group protesting Greek government spending cuts set fire to the building. The victims were in their 30s. They'd done what many young Greeks can only dream of, securing a stable, respectable job. Alex, who's 31, can't get a job, though he speaks several languages and has three master's degrees in chemistry.
I think the situation here is tragic. There's no hope, no jobs, no nothing, no future.
So for the moment, he'll go on living with his mother in a small apartment in a leafy Athenian suburb. According to the Hellenic Statistical Service, Greeks between the ages of 18 and 30, on average, make less than $13,000 a year. Manos Matsaganis, a professor of economics and business at Athens University, says many of these young people are well-educated and, like Alex, won't settle for blue-collar jobs.
Many people believe that such jobs are beneath them, basically, and they prefer to take another option, which is stay at home, stay with their parents, take another degree, then take a third degree.
This idleness has crushed creativity, Matsaganis says. Young people used to wait for a perfect, cushy job in the public sector to come along. Now those jobs are disappearing, so many young Greeks take to the streets of Athens instead and chant for the overthrow of the government. 30-year-old Yanis Bournous wears snazzy shades and a black T-shirt that says, "I still hate Margaret Thatcher." He watches sympathetically as a group of angry young demonstrators pushes by. Yanni says he's very lucky to have an office job that is pretty easy and pays more than $1,000 a month.
Unfortunately, the general situation concerning people of my age is not only bad, not only difficult, but it's constantly and very rapidly deteriorating.
18-year-old Nota Gunda stands outside Parliament under a hand-painted sign that reads, "Don't kill our future." She's just started law school in Athens and expects the austerity cuts will mean years of recession for Greece. It speaks volumes that I'm this young and this disappointed, she says. Prime Minister George Papandreou says he wants to rebuild a Greek economy that's competitive, green, and open to creative young people. But analysts agree it will be years before Greece recovers from this crisis, and even longer before it reinvents itself. As Alex Yokaris washes dishes at home, he stresses about the 4 hours of daily study that lie ahead.
And if you don't do sufficiently well, then you have to take extra courses.
He won't be waiting around in Greece for the upturn to come. In August, he's leaving to pursue a doctorate in organic chemistry at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He won't languish in a menial job in Athens.
If I hadn't studied chemistry, I would, but with a person with my qualifications, I'm hoping for something better.
Like a job as a researcher or a professor, not an overeducated dishwasher. In Athens, I'm Joanna Kakissis for Marketplace.
Coming up, bringing back the family's very famous farm.
The answer that I came up with was that if we could grow these people's lunch, then we could actually remake the place or a version of the place as I'd once known it.
But first, let's do the numbers. So-so jobs report and some lackluster profit predictions carved around 1% off the Dow today. The blue chip index dropped 113 points, finished at 10,782. The NASDAQ gave up 1.25%. That's a loss of 30 points, rather, closed at 2394. The S&P 500 slipped by almost the same margin, trimmed back 14 points to rest at 1157. There was a new shine on U.S. aluminum producers today. You're going to have to follow us on this one. Aluminum producers use a lot of power, and the Chinese government just announced a big hike in electric rates. Analysts say that could end up driving some Chinese smelters out of business, which is kind of a roundabout way of explaining why stock in Century Aluminum jumped more than 5% today. Shares of Alcoa climbed about 2.5%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRowePrice.com. And by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at Elance.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Do much shopping in April? The Commerce Department releases its monthly retail sales report. If all goes as planned, Space Shuttle Atlantis will blast off from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida for its final planned mission. And also in Florida, Spanish language network Univision televises a national immigration forum from its studios, along with a transmission from Phoenix, Arizona. English subtitles provided where available. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. A report out today gives pause to the, hey, American consumers are buying again, theory of economic recovery. MasterCard says retail sales fell in April. To be fair, that is after three straight months of increases, but it's enough to make people worry that shoppers are still kind of skittish. Retailers surely know that. They've adapted, trying harder than ever to get us to spend, and they're doing it by offering less. From St. Louis Public Radio, Adam Allington, When Shopping.
In economics, they call it the paradox of choice, the idea that a shopper, when faced with multiple options, tends to obsess about which item to choose and is consequently less satisfied with the item they do pick. Take, for instance, my ongoing quest to purchase new light fixtures for my kitchen. I'm here in the light fixture section at Home Depot. There's hundreds of lights. I could choose this globe light, there's pendant lights, expensive stained glass models. Morgan Ward studies consumer behavior at the University of Texas. She says this issue of too much choice is at the heart of huge changes in retail shopping.
Generally, customers say they want more stuff to choose from, but what we know from observing how customers deal with products is that they actually are better off with less choices.
Better off because fewer choices mean customers spend less time searching and tend to be more satisfied with the final purchase. The idea spread during the recession when retailers were forced to scale back. Even mega retailer Walmart announced plans to eliminate some 15% of the items in its stores.
Ward says the process of better understanding one's customers pushed companies to go with their strengths at a time when many retailers were trying to do too much.
If you're a generalist, you really get lost in the crowd. Oftentimes, you're not serving anyone that well, and so you're not on any customer's top three. So you're Kmart, essentially, right? You didn't figure out what your customers wanted, and people slowly phased you out.
And it's not just big box stores who've gotten on board with the less is more idea. Lorraine Sugart is the head of PR for craft supplier Joann Fabrics.
The retailers were just trying to give the customer everything. And I think now we're trying to find out what it is they actually want. And let's not give them 20 selections when they really only want three.
And it's not just a matter of removing items from shelves. Joann's is completely redesigning 75 of its locations this year. So far, Sugart says the new stores are outperforming the old ones by 12%. But how different are these stores really? To test the experience, I recruited Allison Rabbit, a St. Louis crafter who makes and sells oven mitts. Allison regularly shops at Joann's, but is often frustrated by the tight aisles and general chaos at her local store.
There's a lot of stuff jammed into one place, and the way the aisles are laid out doesn't make much sense. There's so much fleece. Even in the summer, it's just fleece up to the ceiling. How much fleece do people need?
For comparison's sake, I took Allison to the only redesigned Joann store in the St. Louis area, way out in the suburbs.
Wow, look at that aisle. I think it's easier to get around, you know, because the aisles are much more wide open. I see the word home back there, like home stuff. They have signs up saying what is where.
After about 10 minutes, Allison emerges with the bolt of fabric she was looking for, declaring the new Joann's a roaring success. This less is more trend won't exactly roll out overnight, but retailers like Target, Old Navy, and 7-Eleven have launched pilot programs to redesign stores. And Walmart is spending billions of dollars over the next 5 years to revamp some 2,500 of its retail locations. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
A lot of the conversation that people are having about how to live a more sustainable life revolve around food. Grow it locally, know what you're getting, it'll be better for you and for the planet. Sometimes that means making small changes, sometimes quite big ones. Sissinghurst Castle in Kent, England, has been a popular tourist destination for decades. Its formal gardens have been the main draw, designed by the Bloomsbury poet Vita Sackville-West back in the 1930s. For her grandson, though, Adam Nicholson, Sissinghurst was always much more.
You have this very beautiful ruined Elizabethan mansion, and then around the gardens when I was a boy there was this wonderful farm, a mixed farm with dairy cattle and hop gardens and beautiful ancient Kentish woods, and a feeling that you had the whole world just to hand. There was a really beautiful world just outside your back door.
Life and its obligations took Adam Nicholson away from Sissinghurst for more than 30 years. But when he returned after his father died, Sissinghurst, he says, had lost its soul. The farm was gone, the cows, the chickens, the orchards. But he had a plan.
You know, a lot of people were coming to Sissinghurst, 150,000 a year, and maybe about 115,000 of them would have lunch. But everything that they ate in the restaurant came in by van. The answer that I came up with was that if we could grow these people's lunch, if we could actually grow the meat, the eggs, the fruit, then we could actually remake the place or a version of the place as I'd once known it.
You had the plan, but you didn't have the ability, because Sissinghurst now is no longer belongs to your family. It's part of the National Trust, and they run it, in essence, as part of Britain's heritage and as a tourism operation. Yeah. So how did you convince them that this was going to work?
What I said to them was that they lost sight of the heart of Sissinghurst, that they'd made it incredibly perfectly beautiful in the garden. They'd made it very profitable. I mean, it had always made money. But in doing that, they had abandoned the connections between this lovely garden and the world that I remembered surrounding it. And so I said to them, what you've really
made here is a Titian in a car park. That was the knife I used to stab them with. What you really want to do is to capture the money, essentially, of the people who now believe in authentic places that really are what they claim to be. And one thing that you do and you shouldn't do is can bring in all this food from heaven knows where and sell it as if somehow it was all kind of local product. And they believe me.
Well, they believed you after a series of studies and rejections. And, I mean, it was not...
It was a pretty damn difficult sell. This idea of intense localization is very expensive. The vegetables that the restaurant was serving before my ideas were costing about £30,000 a year. There is no way that we could grow the equivalent quantity of vegetables for less than £90,000 a year, so triple. I persuaded them to get consultants in from the Soil Association, which is the big organic organisation in this country, and they produced a scheme which seemed to work, but then we had another anti-organic set of consultants to rip that apart. And it was only by endless banging on tables combined with sweet, soothing seduction that they changed their mind, and they did.
Is it working now? I mean, are you in the black to get vulgar about it?
Something approaching £1.5 million has been spent on changing the way the farm works, new kit, new buildings, 4.5 acre new vegetable and herb garden, new hay meadows, new woods, new wetlands. But as a result of doing this and talking a lot about it in this country, last year the number of visitors went up from 150,000 to very nearly just short of 200,000. So we well covered extra running costs and started clawing back some of the capital costs.
Are you finished with Sissinghurst yet?
No, I want them to spend so much money. I want. I think that they should triple the size of the orchard, and we should certainly have, wood fuel heating and hot water everywhere. I think that the more Sissinghurst could become a place that looks like it values its own soil, the better. And we've got miles to go on that.
Sissinghurst is the family home of Adam Nicholson and originally his grandmother, Vita Sackville-West. It now belongs to the National Trust over in the UK. His book about it is called Sissinghurst, An Unfinished History. Adam Nicholson, thanks so much for your time.
Lovely to talk to you.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, an update on a story we had earlier this week about Walgreens selling genetic testing kits. You send in a saliva sample and as much as $249, and then the lab lets you know your genetic predisposition to certain diseases. The Food and Drug Administration has apparently decided that is not such a great idea. The tests were not approved by the FDA, and so Walgreens says it has, quote, elected not to move forward. We, however, must, because we're out of time. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 113 points, about 1%. The NASDAQ shaved off 30 points, 1.25%. The S&P 500 down 14 points, almost 1.25%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest and earliest in business and economic news. And coming up next time on this program, Nottingham, England just can't seem to capitalize on its most famous son.
And Nottingham never makes enough. I've never made enough of Robin Hood for the last 800 years. Any other city in the world would give blood to have a hero like Robin Hood.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.